Lieutenant Ryland, the armory officer, was supervising his four subordinates, one from each platoon, who were doing a last-minute check of weapons storage. Probably the most important job on the whole ship, when you contemplate what could happen to all those tons of explosives and radioactives under 25 G's. I returned his perfunctory salute. "Everything going all right, Lieutenant?" "Yes, sir, except for those damned swords."
"For use in the stasis field."
"No way we can orient them that they won't be bent. Just hope they don't break."
I couldn't begin to understand the principles behind the stasis field. The gap between present-day physics and my master's degree in the same subject was as long as the time that separated Galileo and Einstein. But I knew the effects. Nothing could move at greater than 16.3 meters per second inside the field, which was a hemispherical, in space, spherical, volume, about 50 meters in radius. Inside, there was no such thing as electromagnetic radiation, no electricity, no magnetism, no light. From inside your suit, you could see your surroundings in ghostly monochrome, which phenomenon was glibly explained to me as being due to phase transference of quasi-energy leaking through from an adjacent tachyon reality. So much phlogiston to me. The result of it, though, was to make all conventional weapons of warfare useless. Even a Nova bomb was just an inert lump inside the field. And any creature, Terran or Tauran, caught inside the field without the proper insulation would die in a fraction of a second. At first, it looked as though we had come upon the ultimate weapon. There were five engagements where whole Tauran bases were wiped out without any human ground casualties. All you had to do was carry the field to the enemy. Four husky soldiers could handle it in Earth gravity, and watch them die as they slipped in through the field's opaque wall. The people carrying the generator were invulnerable, except for the short periods when they might have to turn the thing off to get their bearings. The sixth time the field was used, though, the Taurans were ready for it. They wore protective suits and were armed with sharp spears with which they could breach the suits of the generator carriers. From then on, the carriers were armed. Only three other such battles had been reported, although a dozen strike forces had gone out with the stasis field. The others were still fighting, or en route, or had been totally defeated. There was no way to tell, unless they came back. And they weren't encouraged to come back if Taurans were still in control of their real estate. Supposedly that constituted desertion under fire, which meant execution for all officers, although rumor had it that they were simply brainwiped, imprinted, and sent back into the fray.
"Will we be using the stasis field, sir?"
Ryland asked.
"Probably. Not at first, not unless the Taurans are already there. I don't relish the thought of living in a suit day in and day out."
Neither did I relish the thought of using sword, spear, throwing knife, no matter how many electronic illusions I'd sent to Valhalla with them.
Checked my watch. "Well, we'd better get on down to the tanks, Captain. Make sure everything's squared away."
We had about 2 hours before the insertion sequence would start.
This ends Disc 6, The Third War, Disc 7.
The room the tanks were in resembled a huge chemical factory. The floor was a good 100 meters in diameter and jammed with bulky apparatus painted a uniform dull gray. The 8 tanks were arranged almost symmetrically around the central elevator. The symmetry spoiled by the fact that one of the tanks was twice the size of the others. That would be the command tank for all the senior officers and supporting specialists. Sergeant Blazinski stepped out from behind one of the tanks and saluted, I didn't return his salute. What the hell is that? In all that universe of gray, there was one spot of color.
It's a cat, sir.
Do tell. A big one, too, and bright calico. It looked ridiculous, draped over the sergeant's shoulder. Let me rephrase the question. What the hell is a cat doing here?
It's the maintenance squad's mascot, sir.
The cat raised its head enough to hiss half-heartedly at me, then returned to its flaccid repose. I looked at Charlie, and he shrugged back.
It seems kind of cruel, he said.
To the sergeant, you won't get much use of it. After 25 G's, it'll be just so much fur and guts.
Oh, no, sir. Sirs.
He roughed back the fur between the creature's shoulders. It had a fluorocarbon fitting embedded there, just like the one above my hip bone.
We bought it at a store on Stargate, already modified. Lots of ships have them now, sir. The Commodore signed the forms for us.
Well, that was her right. Maintenance was under both of us equally, and it was her ship.
You couldn't have gotten a dog?
God, I hated cats. Always sneaking around.
No, sir, they don't adapt. Can't take free fall.
Did you have to make any special adaptations in the tank? Charlie asked.
No, sir, we had an extra couch.
Great. That meant I'd be sharing a tank with the animal.
We only had to shorten the straps.
It takes a different kind of drug for the cell wall strengthening, but that was included in the price. Charlie scratched it behind an ear. It purred softly, but didn't move.
Seems kind of stupid. The animal, I mean. We drugged him ahead of time.
No wonder it was so inert. The drug slows your metabolism down to a rate barely adequate to sustain life.
Makes it easier to strap him in.
Guess it's all right, I said. Maybe good for morale. But if it starts getting in the way, I'll personally recycle it.
Yes, sir,
he said, visibly relieved, thinking that I couldn't really do anything like that to such a cute bundle of fur. Try me, buddy. So we had seen it all. The only thing left, this side of the engines, was the huge hold where the fighters and drones waited, clamped in their massive cradles against the coming acceleration. Charlie and I went down to take a look, but there were no windows on our side of the airlock. I knew there'd be one on the inside, but the chamber was evacuated, and it wasn't worth going through the fill and warm cycle merely to satisfy our curiosity. I was starting to feel really supernumerary. Called Hillebo, and she said everything was under control. With an hour to kill, we went back to the lounge and had the computer mediate a game of Kriegspieler, which was just starting to get interesting, when the 10-minute warning sounded. The acceleration tanks had a half-life to failure of 5 weeks. There was a 50-50 chance that you could stay immersed for 5 weeks before some valve or tube popped and you were squashed like a bug underfoot. In practice, it had to be one hell of an emergency to justify using the tanks for more than 2 weeks acceleration. We were only going under for 10 days, this first leg of our journey. 5 weeks or 5 hours, though, it was all the same as far as the tankee was concerned. Once the pressure got up to an operational level, you had no sense of the passage of time. Your body and brain were concrete. None of your senses provided any input, and you could amuse yourself for several hours just trying to spell your own name. So I wasn't really surprised that no time seemed to have passed when I was suddenly dry, my body tingling with the return of sensation. The place sounded like an asthmatics convention in the middle of a hayfield. 39 people and one cat, all coughing and sneezing to get rid of the last residues of fluorocarbon. While I was fumbling with my straps, the side door opened, flooding the tank with painfully bright light. The cat was the first one out, with a general scramble right behind him. For the sake of dignity, I waited until last. Over 100 people were milling around outside, stretching and massaging out cramps. Dignity. Surrounded by acres of young female flesh, I stared into their faces and desperately tried to solve a third-order differential equation in my head to circumvent the gallant reflex. A temporary expedient, but it got me to the elevator. Hillebo was shouting orders, getting people lined up, and as the doors closed, I noticed that all of one platoon had a uniform light bruise from head to foot. 20 pairs of black eyes. I'd have to see both maintenance and medical about that. After I got dressed. Chapter 4. We stayed at 1G for 3 weeks, with occasional periods of free fall for navigation check, while the Masaryk 2 made a long, narrow loop away from the Collapsar Resh 10 and back again. That period went all right, the people adjusting pretty well to ship routine. I gave them a minimum of busy work and a maximum of training review and exercise, for their own good, though I wasn't naive enough to think they'd see it that way. After about a week of 1G, Private Rudkowski, the cook's assistant, had a still producing some 8 liters a day of 95% ethyl alcohol. I didn't want to stop him. Life was cheerless enough. I didn't mind as long as people showed up for duty sober. But I was damn curious both how he managed to divert the raw materials out of our sealed-tied ecology and how the people paid for their booze. So I used the chain of command in reverse, asking Alcivor to find out. She asked Jarvel, who asked Carreras, who sat down with Orban, the cook. Turned out that Sergeant Orban had set the whole thing up, letting Rudkowski do the dirty work, and was aching to brag about it to a trustworthy person. If I had ever taken meals with the enlisted men and women, I might have figured out that something odd was going on, but the scheme didn't extend up to officers' country. Through Rudkowski, Orban had jury-rigged a ship-wide economy based on alcohol. It went like this. Each meal was prepared with one very sugary dessert, jelly, custard, or flan, which you were free to eat if you could stand the cloying taste. But if it was still on your tray when you presented it at the recycling window, Rudkowski would give you a 10-cent chit and scrape the sugary stuff into a fermentation vat. He had 2 20-liter vats, one working while the other was being filled. The 10-cent chit was at the bottom of a system that allowed you to buy a half-liter of straight ethyl, with your choice of flavoring, for $5. A squad of 5 people who skipped all of their desserts could buy about 1 liter a week, enough for a party, but not enough to constitute a public health problem. When Diana brought me this information, she also brought a bottle of Rudkowski's Worst. Literally. It was a flavor that just hadn't worked. It came up through the chain of command with only a few centimeters missing. Its taste was a ghastly combination of strawberry and caraway seed. With a perversity not uncommon to people who rarely drink, Diana loved it. I had some ice water brought up, and she got totally blasted within an hour. For myself, I made 1 drink and didn't finish it. When she was more than halfway to oblivion, mumbling a reassuring soliloquy to her liver, she suddenly tilted her head up to stare at me with childlike directness. "You have a real problem, Major William." "Not half the problem you'll have in the morning, Lieutenant Doctor Diana." "Oh, not really." She waved a drunken hand in front of her face.
Some vitamins, some glucose, an ECC of adrenaline. If all else fails, you have a real problem. Look, Diana, don't you want me to... What you need is to get an appointment with that nice Corporal Valdez. Valdez was the male sex counselor. He has empathy. It's his job. He'd make you... We talked about this before, remember? I want to stay the way I am. Don't we all? She wiped away a tear that was probably 1% alcohol. You know they call you the old Crear? No, they don't. She looked at the floor and then at the wall. The old Queer, that's what. I had expected names worse than that, but not so soon. I don't care. The commander always gets names. I know, but... She stood up suddenly and wobbled a little bit. Too much to drink. Lie down. She turned her back to me and stretched so hard that a joint popped. Then a seam whispered open, and she shrugged off her tunic, stepped out of it, and tiptoed to my bed. She sat down and patted the mattress. Come on, William. Only chance. For Christ's sake, Diana, it wouldn't be fair. All's fair, she giggled. And besides, I'm a doctor. I can be clinical. Won't bother me a bit. Help me with this. After 500 years, they were still putting brassiere clasps in the back. One kind of gentleman would have helped her get undressed and then made a quiet exit. Another kind of gentleman might have bolted for the door. Being neither kind, I closed in for the kill. Perhaps, fortunately, she passed out before we had made any headway. I admired the sight and touch of her for a long time before, feeling like a cad. I managed to gather everything up and dress her. I lifted her out of the bed, sweet burden, and then realized that if anyone saw me carrying her down to her billet, she'd be the butt of rumors for the rest of the campaign. I called up Charlie, told him we'd had some booze, and Diana was rather the worse for it, and asked him whether he'd come up for a drink and help me haul the good doctor home. By the time Charlie knocked, she was draped innocently in a chair, snoring softly. He smiled at her. Physician, heal thyself. I offered him the bottle with a warning. He sniffed it and made a face. What is this, varnish? Just something the cooks whipped up, vacuum still. He set it down carefully as if it might explode if jarred. I predict a coming shortage of customers, epidemic of death by poisoning. She actually drank that vile stuff? Well, the cooks admitted it was an experiment that didn't pan out. Their other flavors are evidently potable. Yeah, she loved it. Well, he laughed. Damn. What, you take her leg and I take her arms? No, look, we each take an arm. Maybe we can get her to do part of the walking. She moaned a little when we lifted her out of the chair, opened one eye, and said, Hello, Charlie. Then she closed the eye and let us drag her down to the billet. No one saw us on the way, but her bunkmate, Lassonen, was sitting up reading. She really drank the stuff, eh? She regarded her friend with wry affection. Here, let me help. The three of us wrestled her into bed. Lassonen smoothed the hair out of her eyes. She said it was in the nature of an experiment. More devotion to science than I have, Charlie said. A stronger stomach, too. We all wished he hadn't said that. Diana sheepishly admitted that she hadn't remembered anything after the first drink, and talking to her, I deduced that she thought Charlie had been there all along, which was all for the best, of course. But oh, Diana, my lovely latent heterosexual, let me buy you a bottle of good scotch the next time we come into port, 700 years from now.
We got back into the tanks for the hop from Raish 10 to Kof 35. That was 2 weeks at 25 Gs. Then we had another 4 weeks of routine at one gravity. I had announced my open-door policy, but practically no one ever took advantage of it. I saw very little of the troops, and those occasions were almost always negative, testing them on their training review, handing out reprimands, and occasionally lecturing classes. And they rarely spoke intelligibly, except in response to a direct question. Most of them either had English as their native tongue or as a second language, but it had changed so drastically over 450 years that I could barely understand it. Not at all, if it was spoken rapidly. Fortunately, they had all been taught early 21st century English during their basic training. That language, or dialect, served as a temporal lingua franca, through which a 25th century soldier could communicate with someone who had been a contemporary of his 19 times great-grandparents. If there had still been such a thing as grandparents. I thought of my first combat commander, Captain Stott, whom I had hated just as cordially as the rest of the company did, and tried to imagine how I would have felt if he had been a sexual deviant and I'd been forced to learn a new language for his convenience. So we had discipline problems, sure. But the wonder was that we had any discipline at all. Hillebo was responsible for that. As little as I liked her personally, I had to give her credit for keeping the troops in line. Most of the shipboard graffiti concerned improbable sexual geometries between the second field officer and her commander. From Kof 35, we jumped to Samek 78. From there, to IN 129, and finally, to Sada 138. Most of the jumps were no more than a few hundred light years, but the last one was 140,000. Supposedly the longest collapsar jump ever made by a manned craft. The time spent scooting down the wormhole from one collapsar to the next was always the same, independent of the distance. When I'd studied physics, they thought the duration of a collapsar jump was exactly zero. But a couple of centuries later, they did a complicated waveguide experiment that proved the jump actually lasted some small fraction of a nanosecond. It doesn't seem like much, but they'd had to rebuild physics from the foundation up when the collapsar jump was first discovered. They had to tear the whole damn thing down again when they found out it took time to get from A to B. Physicists were still arguing about it. But we had more pressing problems as we flashed out of Sada 138's collapsar field at three-quarters of the speed of light. There was no way to tell immediately whether the Torrens had beat us there. We launched a pre-programmed drone that would decelerate at 300 Gs and take a preliminary look around. It would warn us if it detected any other ships in the system or evidence of Torren activity on any of the collapsar's planets. The drone launched, we zipped up in the tanks, and the computers put us through a 3-week evasive maneuver while the ship slowed down. No problems except that 3 weeks is a hell of a long time to stay frozen in the tank. For a couple of days afterward, everybody crept around like aged cripples. If the drone had sent back word that the Torrens were already in the system, we would immediately have stepped down to 1G and started deploying fighters and drones armed with Nova bombs. Or we might not have lived that long. Sometimes the Torrens could get to a ship only hours after it entered the system. Dying in the tank might not be the most pleasant way to go. It took us a month to get back to within a couple of AUs of Sada 138, where the drone had found a planet that met our requirements. It was an odd planet, slightly smaller than Earth, but more dense. It wasn't quite the cryogenic deep freeze that most portal planets were, both because of heat from its core and because S. Doradus, the brightest star in the cloud, was only a third of a light year away. The strangest feature of the planet was its lack of geography. From space, it looked like a slightly damaged billiard ball. Our resident physicist, Lieutenant Gim, explained its relatively pristine condition by pointing out that its anomalous, almost cometary orbit probably meant that it had spent most of its life as a rogue planet, drifting alone through interstellar space. The chances were good that it had never been struck by a large meteor until it wandered into Sada 138's bailiwick and was captured, forced to share space with all the other flotsam the Collapsar dragged around with it. We left the Masaryk 2 in orbit. It was capable of landing, but that would restrict its visibility and getaway time, and shuttled building materials down to the surface with the 6 fighters. It was good to get out of the ship, even though the planet wasn't exactly hospitable. The atmosphere was a thin, cold wind of hydrogen and helium, it being too cold, even at noon, for any other substance to exist as a gas. Noon was when S. Doradus was overhead, a tiny, painfully bright spark. The temperature slowly dropped at night, going from 25 degrees Kelvin down to 17 degrees, which caused problems, because just before dawn, the hydrogen would start to condense out of the air, making everything so slippery that it was useless to do anything other than sit down and wait it out. At dawn, a faint pastel rainbow provided the only relief from the black and white monotony of the landscape. The ground was treacherous, covered with little granular chunks of frozen gas that shifted slowly, incessantly, in the anemic breeze. You had to walk in a slow waddle to stay on your feet. Of the 4 people who would die during the base's construction, 3 would be the victims of simple falls. The troops weren't happy with my decision to construct the anti-spacecraft and perimeter defenses before putting up living quarters. That was by the book, though, and they got 2 days of shipboard rest for every day planetside, which wasn't overly generous, I admit, since ship days were 24 hours long, and a day on the planet was 38.5 hours, from dawn to dawn. The base was completed in just less than 4 weeks, and it was a formidable structure indeed. The perimeter, a circle 1 kilometer in diameter, was guarded by 25 gigawatt lasers that would automatically aim and fire within 1/1000th of a second. They would react to the motion of any significantly large object between the perimeter and the horizon. Sometimes, when the wind was right and the ground damp with hydrogen, the little ice granules would stick together into a loose snowball and begin to roll. They wouldn't roll far. For early protection, before the enemy came over our horizon, the base was in the center of a huge minefield. The buried mines would detonate upon sufficient distortion of their local gravitational fields. A single Tauran would set one off if he came within 20 meters of it. A small spacecraft, 1 kilometer overhead, would also detonate it. There were 2,800 of them, mostly 100 microton nuclear bombs. 50 of them were devastatingly powerful tachyon devices. They were all scattered at random in a ring that extended from the limit of the laser's effectiveness out another 5 kilometers. Inside the base, we relied on individual lasers, microton grenades, and a tachyon-powered repeating rocket launcher that had never been tried in combat, 1 per platoon. As a last resort, the stasis field was set up beside the living quarters. Inside its opaque gray dome, as well as enough Paleolithic weaponry to hold off the Golden Horde, we'd stashed a small cruiser, just in case we managed to lose all our spacecraft in the process of winning a battle. 12 people would be able to get back to Stargate. It didn't do to dwell on the fact that the other survivors would have to sit on their hands until relieved by reinforcements, or death. The living quarters and administration facilities were all underground to protect them from line-of-sight weapons. It didn't do too much for morale, though. There were waiting lists for every outside detail, no matter how strenuous or risky. I hadn't wanted the troops to go up to the surface in their free time, both because of the danger involved and the administrative headache of constantly checking equipment in and out and keeping track of who was where. Finally, I had to relent and allow people to go up for a few hours every week. There was nothing to see except the featureless plain and the sky, which was dominated by S. Doradus during the day, and the huge dim oval of the galaxy at night. But that was an improvement over staring at the melted rock walls and ceiling. A favorite sport was to walk out to the perimeter and throw snowballs in front of the laser. See how small a snowball you could throw and still set the weapon off. It seemed to me that the entertainment value of this pastime was about equal to watching a faucet drip. But there was no real harm in it, since the weapons would only fire outward, and we had power to spare. For 5 months, things went pretty smoothly. Such administrative problems as we had were similar to those we'd encountered on the Masaryk II, and we were in less danger, as passive troglodytes, than we had been scooting from Collapsar to Collapsar, at least until the enemy showed up. I looked the other way when Rudkoski reassembled his still. Anything that broke the monotony of garrison duty was welcome, and the chits not only provided booze for the troops, but gave them something to gamble with. I only interfered in two ways. Nobody could go outside unless they were totally sober, and nobody could sell sexual favors. Maybe that was the Puritan in me, but it was, again, by the book. The opinion of the supporting specialists was split. Lieutenant Wilbur, the psychiatric officer, agreed with me. The sex counselors, Cogdi and Valdez, didn't. But then they were probably coining money, being the resident professionals. 5 months of comfortably boring routine. And then along came Private Graubard. For obvious reasons, no weapons were allowed in the living quarters. The way these people were trained, even a fist fight could be a duel to the death, and tempers were short. 100 merely normal people would probably have been at each other's throats after a week in our caves, but these soldiers had been hand-picked for their ability to get along in close confinement. Still, there were fights. Graubard had almost killed his ex-lover, Sean, when that worthy made a face at him in the chow line. He had a week of solitary detention. So did Sean, for having precipitated it. And then psychiatric counseling and punitive details. Then I transferred him to the 4th platoon, so he wouldn't be seeing Sean every day. The first time they passed in the halls, Graubard greeted Sean with a karate kick to the throat. Diana had to build him a new trachea. Graubard got a more intensive round of detention, counseling, and details. Hell, I couldn't transfer him to another company. And then he was a good boy for 2 weeks. I fiddled their work and chow schedules so the two would never be in the same room together. But they met in a corridor again. And this time, it came out more even. Sean got 2 broken ribs, but Graubard got a ruptured testicle and lost 4 teeth. If it kept up, I was going to have at least 1 less mouth to feed. By the Universal Code of Military Justice, I could have ordered Graubard executed, since we were technically in a state of combat. Perhaps I should have, then and there. But Charlie suggested a more humanitarian solution, and I accepted it.